This is Mae Brussel, and it's program number 673, October the 29th, 1984. Just citing some chapters in Ronald Reagan's life to show the escalation of his career. I call it a coup d'etat in this country. Evans and Novak call it a Reagan revolution. It was really a revolution to fascism, the way it slid in, but they describe in a book that I just read this weekend the career of Ronald Reagan and a few turning points in his life that are pertinent to the way America is going now. And they're the ones who tell that the WHO station in Des Moines merged with the NBC station, and how Reagan went to Santa Catalina Island and made trips, several such trips. And in 1937, before the Cubs went home, he decided to, he wanted to go into acting, met a woman named Joy Hodges, who took him to William Meeklejohn, and the arrangements were made. The contract was made for him to begin right away at Warner Brothers. And they say, Evans and Novak, that no previous president of the United States had so bizarre a preparation for political office. And you might say in Nazi Germany, with all the heads of states of Europe, that no previous leader had so bizarre a preparation for office as Adolf Hitler. They said Reagan alone among recent presidents without benefit of special education or capital resources went from town to town and parlayed his intelligence and talent. Well, he only had to ask one person in Hollywood, Joy Hodges, who was singing at the Biltmore Bowl, "I'd like to be an actor." And he all of a sudden is drawing $500 a week at Warner Brothers, and then goes to General Electric Theater and becomes the governor of California with so little knowledge or expertise, and then the president of the United States. All the doors seemed to be open for him, and he seemed to be the right person. Evans and Novak say that starting in 1937, Reagan's liberalism was limited in those days. He was appalled at the taxes taken by the government, and he objected to the graduate income tax. This is in 1937. He didn't like taxes on the government, and the quotation, "I abhor the communist philosophy," came out in 1951. And his relationship to Nancy Davis is described with the multimillionaire surgeon, militant conservative Republican, but he doesn't say in this book, it's from the other book, the relationship of Dr. Loyal Davis to Willoughby down in the Philippines. This career of Reagan becomes more political and more radical. By 1952, he was a Democrat for Eisenhower. In 1960, the Democrat for Nixon. Oh, I thought it was 52 was reversed. I had the dates wrong. He was Democrat for Nixon in 60. Then became a Republican and joined the General Electric circuit and got to be, get known around the state and around the country, of course, the national circuit. But then it said Reagan joined the grassroots revolt of the Republican Party workers who in 1964 destroyed decades of Eastern establishment control over the party's national machinery. In 1964, he grabbed control over the what was the Eastern Party's national machinery. When John Kennedy was murdered in 1963, that is when we had the coup. And by 1964, decades of work by the Eastern establishment were done in, and Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon then would be in control of the White House from then on. It tells about Mr. Holmes Tuttle, a millionaire Ford dealer. You have to go back to the massive program of Henry Ford with Adolf Hitler during the entire war, up to it, and afterwards supplying them with tanks and anti-violently anti-Semitic literature. Mr. Holmes Tuttle was one of the people with behind Ronald Reagan, and also an A.C. Rubel and Henry Salvatore. And I'll go back more into Salvatore later, handpicked by Patrick Frawley, a Knight of Malta, who introduced Salvatore to Ronald Reagan, and the links to the Kennedy assassination. I'll do an entire broadcast on that soon. I've done some of it before. They turned him over to Stu Spencer and Bill Roberts, the managers of his speeches, and they told him his rhetoric had to be soft to get elected. And in this book of Evans and Novak, they said the first sign that was followed by many, many more of years was that Reagan would do whatever was needed to win. Whether he diluted his rhetoric or dropped his old friends, he used the Spencer Roberts guideline. He had a limited denunciation of the John Birch Society while he expanded his links with them And he would say, what they're saying is, anything he wanted to say while the Reagan Revolution rolled on. It also tells about the role of Alexander Haig coming into the Reagan White House when he was president, and how Haig's big shtick was to go into the subject of terrorism, which is what George Shultz is going to do now to set up our death squads officially on the books, and how he worked with his friend Claire Sterling, an esteemed foreign correspondent based in Rome. Haig working closely, he's a Knight of Malta, and we're closing with P2 and Licio Gelli and the team that wanted a military coup in Italy, a fascist coup, whereas we had one here that quietly slipped by without too many people noticing. And Haig working with Claire Sterling, sitting outside the White House prior to when the oath of office was taken by the president, getting ready to spring all of this, even before his confirmation hearings. He had studies from Stanford and from Rome, from Claire Sterling, his friend, to begin the terrorism shtick. And, of course, the CIA and other parts of the government and the P2 set up the bread brigades and the terrorists as an excuse to close down on the terrorists like they did in the United States with the SLA. As far as the Christian right and the fundamentalists, this book by Evans and Novak, talking about Reagan's revolution, talks about Paul M. Weirich, W-E-R-I-C-H. You've seen him lately or a lot in the news. And Richard Vagary from Young Americans for Freedom. We're going now to 1980 and Reagan's in the White House. And Mr. Weirich is the person escalating this 1984 election along with Vagary. They combine their talents, and he describes Weirich in those days when Reagan came in 1980 as a 37-year-old political organizer who flew from Washington but was no preacher. He wasn't even a Protestant. He was born and raised a Roman Catholic. He joined the Eastern Rite Catholic Church when Rome liberalized their liturgy. He was so rigid in his theology. And 6 years early, before he helped Reagan in 1980, he was financed by Joseph Kerr, the beer baron and the conservative activist from Golden, Colorado. Money was put into Weirich's hand to form the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress, a new right political action group to finance and organize conservative campaigns starting in 1979, so eventually the new right can throw out all the liberal congressmen and fascism will be elected by 1988, just as Hitler got elected in 1933, a continuous rout of people with the same links or goals. So by 1979, they were running out for the 1980 elections, people like Senator Frank Church, who opened up the mind control programs and the assassination teams of the CIA and so forth. They get a good job of cleaning out Congress, and they'll do better this next week. So Weirich was funded by Joseph Kurz. He was a rigid, devout Catholic. And what he did was he took his money south and went to the born-again pastors. He went to the pastor of the huge Forest Hills Baptist Church in Decatur, Georgia. Mr. Pinnell had passively supported a Georgian, the born-again Christian, Jimmy Carter. And also running against him was George born-again Christian, John Anderson. And to the fundamentalists, they gave a lot of money. They would say that the Satan abroad was a godless communism in Moscow. These were their quotes. And Satan was in the form of anti-family and drugs and pornography. And so Reagan came in on every one of these issues with a clean slate, and Reagan became the man of faith. So Mr. Paul Weirich, from Rome, a devout Catholic, funded by Mr. Kurz with the money, could go down to the fundamentalist Christian churches and to Congress and organize the committees to get into Congress the people and the appointments they wanted. And along with that revolution, they call it a Reagan Revolution, and it goes way, way back, comes Mr. Richard Vagary. He came out directly out of the Young Americans for Freedom, the Willoughby Morris Buckley Reagan group of conservatives, and they combined, and according to Evans and Novak, the way that Reagan got in before was a combination of the Young Americans for Freedom, organizers, fundraisers such as Richard Vagary and Howard Phillips, and especially Paul Weirich of the conservative right, working with and bringing up the prominence of the electronic church. There was a lot of news coverage this past week on the tribulation and the electronic church and the beliefs of the millennium and so forth. I'm not going into those now, but these things were funded by the Vatican and Mr. Kurz through Weirich and his organization, clinging Congress and setting up the churches, and Young Americans for Freedom with their computers, working with people like Reverend Moon and the organizations that create CAUSA that support the Contras down in Central America or down in Paraguay, Uruguay, Mexico. Moon has his own armies, and that money came through Young Americans for Freedom and through William Buckley and the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, this book tells about the new breed of electronic preachers. They abandoned the rhetoric of their pioneer, the Reverend Billy Graham, who was put in by Luce and William Randolph Hearst, and they went on their own. The Reverend James Robeson in Dallas, and he's the one who gave the opening invocation at the Republican Convention, he preached a politically muscular Christianity. The Reverend Pat Robertson, the son of the late Senator A. Willis Robertson of Virginia, was another one of the electronic preachers. Pat Robertson was on TV this week on Phil Donahue, telling how he works for W.R. Grace & Company. He's a lawyer from Yale, and he is probably the richest and strongest outside of Jerry Falwell. And then they describe Jerry Falwell in this book and his lunge into politics, the Reverend Jerry Falwell of Lynchburg, Virginia, who was attracted, when the book was written, $12 million from his old-fashioned gospel hour. And the basis of the moral majority was the Reverend Bob Billings, along with Falwell. So you have Mr. Warwick with strong religious backgrounds getting into politics, clinging up the Congress, clinging up the White House candidates, writing the platform for the Republican Party and spreading their gospel at the same time. And this goes back to the intent of what would happen had Hitler lost the war, the Nazis go underground, and the Martin Bormann money and the continuous links into people like Ronald Reagan, who started with a background of people going to the fascism of Willoughby, to Lloyd Davis, to Nancy Davis. Those are not coincidences. Or the Christian right, who they involve Lauren Hall or William Seymour, and people wanted for the assassination of John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan won't extradite Mr. Bradley to the trial of Jim Garrison. Then also in this book on the new revolution, there's an interesting point here, how they bring in Al Haig, and Al Haig thinks that, like with John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, that he's going to run the whole Department of Foreign Policy. And the conflict that came in, he thought he would be the vicar of Washington. Remember when Ronald Reagan was shot and he got up and said he was the vicar. And this tells about the fighting going on between Haig, because he was so big and he thought of himself as being virtually the second president for foreign policy, that he would take over and make the decisions, and that his delusions of this power were nurtured so much that they described the problem of putting him down. But this book goes on to say that Mr. Meese, Edwin Meese, trained to honor the staff system through long experience with Ronald Reagan, because Edwin Meese is holding the fort for those old-timers, not the Haig Kissinger yet. Haig isn't in charge yet. He's holding the line. Meese was trained to hold this line with Ronald Reagan and with Mr. Baker, was guarding against any personality cult that might weaken George Bush, the heir apparent. So they had to cut down Haig. Haig was cut out in June 82 from this group. His friend Kissinger still running it, but the heir apparent is announced right here, and you can look for that. And if you see pictures of Ronald Reagan falling on the steps or sounding like his mind is wandering, he can go anywhere he wants 8 days from now, because heir apparent is sitting there in vice president, and the agency he was the head of, the CIA, was formed by Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, another knight of Malta from the Vatican, and James Angleton, another knight of Malta from the Vatican, so that they tried to cut him down and separate Haig from the power in the White House, because the next heir apparent happens to be George Bush. Now, those are a few statements from the book, The Reagan Revolution, by Evans and Novak. And the remaining 10 minutes, I'm going into a little more about where Errol Flynn was at the time that he was operating and making movies. Very important. If I don't cover it all, I'll pick up some of it next week. Maybe I can talk fast and do the rest of it in 10 minutes. We'll see. But I'm going to read you sections, and you may have the book. If you don't have, get it. From Errol Flynn, The Untold Story by Charles Higham. It was published in 1980. It's a paperback, and you can get it from Research up in Capitol. I'll give you the address, or Aptos. The Untold Story by Charles Heim of Errol Flynn. And I'm just going into a few space periods of where he was prior to and when he was making movies with Ronald Reagan. And don't tell me that the entire Defense Department, the space stations, the astronauts that are up there brought in by the Nazis that were war criminals, and the Project Paperclip, all the expertise of this country would allow Ronald Reagan to make decisions for those people if he wasn't screened out before he met Nancy Davis and before he escalated on his career. Now, here's a few quotations from the book. I'll jump around. They aren't all in consecutive order. Just where Flynn was. In March 1928, during the last week of his making the movie Four's a Crowd, his friend Urban, who was a member of the Gestapo at the time, returned from a trip to the Orient. He went to San Pedro. Immigration inspectors threatened to arrest Urban. Urban lied that Errol Flynn lied that he didn't know where Urban was. He was a close friend of his. They'd been friends for 8 years at that point. So Errol quickly helped him get on his yacht and take him to Mexico. Urban dodged them and sailed to Mexico and the Panama Canal. This was before the yacht, on the SS Triton. He traveled to New York in April of 38, and he got himself into a meeting of the reunion of the Lincoln Brigade of American supporters, the Loyalists. Then he reported to the Nazi spy group who was at the meeting. Then he went to the Nazi German consulate in New York in the black shirt Nazi dinner in Yonkers on April 21st to celebrate the birthday of Adolf Hitler. It was the 85th Street meeting hall of the German-American Bund. 4 days later, he was at the passport division, and he was questioned, and they saw his Nazi documents, and he was very bold. He boasted about his Nazi sons. He showed pictures of them in uniform. And while he was gone, this is a 1938 period, Austria was annexed by Hitler. At that point, Urban was issued a Nazi card dated May 1st, 1938, waiting for him in Munich, and they were going to send it to New York for him, but it hadn't arrived yet at that time. But he was a full-fledged member of the Nazi Party. He applied to work at the Civilian Conservation Corps in the United States, which was training civilians in case of war. And then as a camp doctor, and he was at Fort Moultrie in South Carolina, talking about Gestapo philosophy and praising Adolf Hitler. Then he was sent to the Civilian Conservation Corps in Sebring, Florida, and he could take photographs of methods, installations, guns, and weapons, and discuss Nazis openly at that place at the CCC. And the efforts to revoke his citizenship began to be reactivated. He had been made a citizen in the United States, just as I said Joseph Mengele was and is, and that hasn't been revoked yet. They even talked about that, and that's controversial. Now, Errol Flynn, late 1940, Errol comes to the aid of Dr. Urban aboard Sirocco, S-I-R-O-C-C-O, in the fall of 1940 and early the winter. Noticing that Urban's case was received by the German consul, Fritz Wiedemann, that they were on his tail and that Errol Flynn was going to help him because the powers that be knew he was a Nazi spy, the German consul general in San Francisco and George Geisling, G-Y-S-S-L-I-N-G, the German consul in L.A., got in touch with Dr. Urban, asked him to join the ABWER, the German military intelligence, in Mexico City and train in microdot and microfilm techniques, which he later does. And then he was transferred to the Orient, where he was a founding member of the Nazi spy ring in Shanghai and worked with another well-known New York journalist named Hans Adolf Mosberg, who happened to be a Jew, and they gave him honorary Aryan in return for his services to Adolf Hitler. There was no problem for them. At that point, he was traveling abroad, and later he went. Errol Flynn helped him go to Mexico. He couldn't get in the United States. The FBI's failure to find Dr. Urban and Errol Flynn shows how bad they were working at the time. I don't think the FBI wanted to find them. And at the time Charles Heim wrote this in 1980, he's giving them credit for trying and not doing it. It says, according to W. E. Williamson, one of the leading figures in military intelligence in Asia under General Douglas MacArthur, military intelligence was aware of Urban's connections and Errol Flynn's connections all along. Now, the chief of intelligence of Douglas MacArthur was Charles Willoughby, and under him was Colonel Williamson. So Errol Flynn and Dr. Urban were working with Williamson and Douglas MacArthur in the Philippines. Dr. Loyal Davis is down in the Philippines with Douglas MacArthur and Mr. Willoughby, and goes back to Chicago. Now, Errol Flynn goes from there to Hollywood and is co-starring in 1940 and 1942 with Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan is going to marry the daughter of a man who is down there with Urban and Errol Flynn. This gets a little too close to the relationship of this pro-Mussolini Willoughby to being on the Young Americans for Freedom with Reagan, Errol Flynn and Urban working with Willoughby and Williamson in the Philippines with Douglas MacArthur, and Loyal Davis and Nancy, lo and behold, arrives in Hollywood. Now, this story, according to Charles Hyam, and I think he was more naive in 1980 than 1984, tells about how Errol Flynn went to Spain with Dr. Irvin. They were traveling a while back, and the British intelligence had wanted him. I'm not sure how much they want him. Again, the FBI. He says they wanted him. They would have asked why Flynn paid Irvin's legal fees, gave him shelter when Flynn's country was at war with Germany, and why he aided and abetted Dr. Irvin by helping him get aboard vessels, and invited Irvin's Nazi sons to stay at his home, and why he hid Irvin on his yacht while Britain was fighting their enemy, Nazi Germany. Now, when Mr. Fritz Kramer was put in the American Army uniform, the books on Fritz Kramer, the article by Nick Thamish in the Washington Post said his brother was wanted as a Nazi in Great Britain and held there while Fritz Kramer came to America and put on American uniform. Now, to go on with this as much as we have time to, in Mexico City, Urban reported to the Consul General von Wallenberg at the Gestapo headquarters, located strangely enough in a former convent, where Urban was given intensive spy work and microdotting. Then, with a forged German passport under the alias Alois Ecker, E-C-K-E-R, the ship's musician, he sailed to Los Angeles in February. He used the name Ecker because it was a friend of his in Vienna. Errol Flynn was in Honolulu as a guest of Captain James Robb of Pearl Harbor Naval Base, taking films and photographs and notes. Now, this is the time period when he's going to make a movie. Pearl Harbor is going to come shortly after that. They're down there in the 40s, just before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and they are assisting in taking pictures. In 1943, Errol Flynn claimed he didn't know about the what was going on in Japan, but Urban was with Errol Flynn taking pictures. Errol was in Honolulu, and Jack Warner cabled him. He wanted him to appear in a picture called Dive Bomber that would illustrate the problems of Naval Air Corps flyers during their intensive training. Navy intelligence records showed that Urban, Errol Flynn's friend, was active with Nazis in South America, and they were reluctant to put him on the sets of the San Diego Naval Base or to go to Japan, and Jack Warner, through his personal troubleshooter, Colonel William Guthrie, coaxed Washington. So great was the power of Hollywood studios that the Secretary of Navy overruled the others and ordered the San Diego Navy base to put at Warner Brothers' disposal. This is in 1941. They made the movie Dive Bomber with graphic portrayal of secret installations and aircraft carrier decks, and they were shipped, as Errol undoubtedly hoped, directly to Japan. The films were shipped to Japan. Some more on this book. They died with their boots on. This is a movie that Errol Flynn made in this period. They died with their boots on. Errol was frequently in Mexico. The FBI agents traced him there. He mingled with an extraordinary group of expatriates, including, this is in 1941. He made his first movie with Ronald Reagan in 40. And now in 41, they are separated until they get back in 42. So this is the year between movies. Errol Flynn is with FBI agents, have trailed him everywhere. He's with expatriates and Gestapo and Abwehr. By that period, 700 Nazi agents poured into Mexico from the United States, Japan, Central America, and Spain. In her brilliant book, Covering the Mexican Front, Washington Post correspondent Betty Kirk wrote, "These agents were prepared for the Axis conquest of Mexico. Germans were on the streets in cafes, bars, and nightclubs. They rang out of cocktail bars yelling, 'Death to the Jew, Roosevelt. Germany's coming victory will be very soon.'" And they talked about the coming victory. Errol's most frequent visits were to the apartment of George Nicholas, N-I-C-O-L-A-U-S, of the Nazi Party, and his associate Hans Hellermann. Errol and Urban's Gestapo contact in Barcelona, and every day they were guarded night and day by the German and Mexican police so they would be safe. And from Mexico, this is in 1941, Errol flew to the Bahamas in early October, the guest of Axel Wennergren, the Swedish creator of Electra locks, estimated at $1 billion wealth, then probably the wealthiest man in the world. From there, he made his money through the munitions he made sent to Hitler. From there, they went to visit Goering. They arranged for Hitler to see Errol Flynn. He saw Errol Flynn. And this is the story of Errol Flynn going with his close friend to Germany from Nassau and into Europe to visit Wernergren. Was above the law, above international law. When Errol arrived by Wernergren's private plane, he was greeted by his host at Nassau with the good news that he would be on the yacht, the Southern Cross, bought from Howard Hughes for $1 million with handpicked Nazis on the staff of the finest chefs on Wernergren's yacht. Wernergren introduced Errol to the multimillionaire Canadian Sir Harry Oakes, who was later to be murdered, and that's another long broadcast or two. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor, who shared their admiration for Hitler. He was in ideal company. Errol Flynn spent 2 weeks with them at Cuernavaca, and then he goes on and he has his relationship going with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. He had been in Nazi Germany and Rudolf Hess, and was on the yacht with Wernergren. Now, this is the time period, as I say, that he is making movies in between and with Ronald Reagan. Now, because of the common Philippines connections and the studio connections and the intrigue of and persuasiveness of Errol Flynn and Dr. Urban, I believe that, and the way that Ronald Reagan's picked up by General Electric with their close affiliations with I.G. Farben and his friend Mr. Tuttle with the Ford Motor Company, Reagan was hand-picked all along. I believe the contacts at Catalina Island were the first clue. He's moving right into a contract at Warner Brothers. Incidentally, and not separately from it, Errol Flynn lived through this whole time period at 601 Walden Drive, and my parents' home is about seven houses away from there. It's there, 615, one street north of or west of that. And there, if you walk down five houses and then to the left, it's where Errol Flynn lived during all this Gestapo period when I was going to Beverly High. And I also was very close to the family of Jack Warner. Jack Warner and my parents were good friends, and they were staunch members of our congregation, very religious people. And Jack Warner's niece, Evelyn Halpert, was his sister's daughter, was my best friend through those years when I went to high school. And we saw a lot of these personalities at the Warner home, and I was in and out of those homes at that time period and totally not aware of anything that was going on. And then Evelyn married my second husband about 1972-73, the niece of Jack Warner. And Jack Warner knew that Errol Flynn was working in the Gestapo and didn't want it known because it wouldn't sell movies. That's why I say the role of none of these people is pure or good. That's why that play of Mr. Steiner's is so great, because the Jews of Hollywood, Louis Mayer and Jack Warner, two people that were very close to my parents and I grew up around and with, never breathed a word about Hitler and wanted Hitler to win. Secretly, we never heard that Nazi was bad, and to this day, you can't say among that circle anything about Nazis. You can talk about Holocaust, period, but not about Nazis, and that is the brilliance of the playwright, because in all of this milieu of these people brewing, hundreds of them in Hollywood having celebrations in Mexico because Hitler is going to win and continue this Holocaust, these men working, Santa Fe Trail was the movie that Errol Flynn made with Ronald Reagan, and it was well known that through the circles around Hollywood of Errol Flynn's link to the Gestapo. And Reagan describes in the movie, in the book that Charles Higham did, I Made Santa Fe Trail with Errol Flynn, and he tells that he wanted a job interrogating a Gestapo chief, and he was mad because Flynn took the scene and Reagan wanted it, but Errol Flynn wanted that scene, and so it was his. But the story of the elections this next week and forevermore is the story of us. It is the story of looking the other way. All this material is public domain. I didn't make it up, and it's there for you to see. And it is the American tragedy. It's what Evans and Novak called the American Revolution. It is a revolution of the right, and the only blood that spilled were the witnesses to the assassination and the political leaders that would have stood in the way, such as Adlai Stevenson, Hubert Humphrey, even Nelson Rockefeller, anyone, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, anybody that was in the way of these people. The power was made a long time ago. The decisions were made, I believe, for Reagan in Illinois and for Nixon when he got out of the Navy. And the road was cleared for them to bring in the Fritz Kramers and the Kissingers and the Haigs and George Bush, the selected heir, the former director of the CIA. Well, that's enough for now. I will not do too much on the election next week. I may just, I don't know what I'll do. That's 7 days away. We'll see what happens. Take care. This is Mae Brussel. I'll be back with you next week. And this is from Pacific Grove, California.